hours. Wind from the west at 12. The wind chill stands at 13 below. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have 2 interviews for you today. One, a brand new interview with a big name from the world of classic television. And then out of the archives, a tale of amazing courage set in the heart of Alaska. Stay with us. And I feel a very, very special delight in speaking for the next few minutes on WGTD's morning show with the one and only Burt Ward, known to millions as the Boy Wonder in the iconic 1960s television series Batman, opposite Adam West. And Burt Ward, in addition to all that he has accomplished, is also a devoted dog lover. And he and his wife, Tracy, have actually created something called Gentle Giants Rescue that has saved the lives of thousands and thousands of dogs, and in particular, large dogs that sometimes can be prone to exceptional mistreatment. And so it is an important thing that they are doing. We are recording this on National Take Your Dog for a Walk Day, and this is National Train Your Dog Month. So we're going to spend most of our time talking about the beautiful life of dogs around us and what we can do to make their lives better. Burt Ward, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, citizen.
Good to be talking to you. When did you become a dog lover?
Well, actually, I've been a dog lover my whole life, but I really got involved with it when my wife and I, 25 years ago, moved to about an hour east of Los Angeles with our young daughter and decided to get her a large breed dog. We wanted either a Great Dane or an Irish Wolfhound. And when we did some research, we found out that there was no rescue for Great Danes, that the lady had been doing it, had actually died, and all the Danes that were given up by people where they had to move or something like that were going into shelters and being put to death, which we found absolutely upsetting because Great Danes are giant babies, you know? So it was the first week in August of 1994 that I said to my wife, Tracy, I said, we can't let these dogs die. How about we rescue these beautiful Great Danes from the shelters just for a couple of weeks so we find somebody else to take over this rescue? Well, the first month, we had more than 100 at our house. And guess what? It's been 25 years, and I'm a patient guy, but nobody has taken over this rescue. So we now have gone from Great Danes to 45 different breeds. And when you consider there's only 164 breeds of dogs altogether, we are rescuing about one-third of all the breeds of dogs. And they all live here in our home with us at all times. We have a minimum of 50. And we've altogether rescued 15,500 in 25 years.
Incredible.
So this is it's a big deal. But what I want to share with your listeners, what's most important, in the course of saving so many lives, we actually found a way to help all dogs live longer, healthier, happier lives, up to 27 years. And I don't know if you're a dog owner, but I guarantee you, you've probably never heard of dogs living that long. And our dogs are so healthy, they're still running around like puppies in their 20s.
That is incredible, and especially for large breed dogs to live that long. I know that one of the things that you have done is that not only is your Gentle Giants Rescue itself nonprofit, but also a line of dog food that you and your wife have helped to create that is also nonprofit that helps to support the work of the rescue. What is the mistake that often people make in terms of what they feed their dogs and how much they feed their dogs?
Well, here's the problem, is that we get calls every week from people who say things like, you know, my dog's allergic to just about every food, no matter what I'm feeding. And it turns out that they're really not allergic to the food. They're allergic to the fat content in the food. One of the things that we don't do is that we found out that many dog foods have a significant increase of fat added to them, because that makes dogs hungrier to eat more dog food, to ultimately make you buy more dog food. Also, if you've ever felt dog food, and I don't know if you have a dog, but your listeners who have dogs, just go feel the outside of the food. Rub in your fingers and put the food down and rub your fingers together, or rub the inside of the dog's bowl or the inside of the bag. You're going to feel a greasy feeling. Why is that? Because the outside has been sprayed after the food is made with animal fat, because it makes dogs hungrier to eat more food. Well, if you think about it, you wouldn't take bacon grease and pour it down your garbage disposal at home, because you know it would clog it and ruin it once it hardens. So why would anybody feed an animal a dog food that every single kibble is encapsulated in animal fat? What is it doing to their intestines and arteries? This is just a few things. There are so much more information. We invite people, come to our website, gentlegiantsdogfood.com. My wife and I take no salary from our rescue. We take no salary from our dog food. We put out the finest dog food in the world, and because we don't take money from it, it actually retails in Walmart and other stores for less than half the price of what you would pay in a pet store. So our motto has become half the price and twice the life. Gentle Giants is good for all dogs, all ages.
Very nicely put. So we are speaking in the midst of National Train Your Dog Month, and my wife and I actually happen to have a rambunctious golden retriever puppy at home, so we are well acquainted with the challenge of, first of all, a larger breed, and also the challenge of getting a dog well-trained. What do you think are the central hallmarks of a well-trained dog? What are the most important things for a dog owner to think about in terms of how to train their dog?
Well, there's lots of things, but first thing is communication. If you're able to communicate what you want for your dog to do, your dog is a willing participant. Dogs love their pet parents, okay? And they want to do anything that will make you happy. The problem is people aren't able to communicate. In other words, if you want your dog, for example, to stop barking, okay, you have to be able to communicate that to your dog so that your dog understands that's what you want, because they want to please you. But if you can't communicate with them, you're not able to tell them what you want them to do. So communication, we teach people how to develop that communication. It's all on our website at gentlegiantsdogfood.com. And we teach people also how very important ways to feed your dog. For example, you know, a dog, most dogs, in the case of your dog, by the time your dog is 8 or 9 years of age, if you don't follow some of the steps I'm telling you, your dog's going to be at a point where they start to have a problem get up. Your dog will start to have a problem walking. And that's because the dog's energy is being prematurely expended. And it's a little bit of a complicated concept, but in a nutshell, what happens with most dogs, if they don't die of cancer, they don't get hit by a car, they get to a point where they can't get up. And even though they're mentally alert, they're physically not able to get up. And unfortunately, at 10, 11, 12, that's when they end up being taken to veterinarians and put to sleep. Now, we've changed all that. And how did we do that? Because of a sophisticated technique in which we we managed to reduce the stress in the dog's body to conserve energy. You know, on Batman, we had those hourglasses. If you remember that, the villains would turn over the hourglass and the sands of time were running out. Your dog's energy is like that. If you can slow down the spending of energy and prolong it, it gives your dog more life. And here's our concept. Every stress, no matter how small it is, that you can remove today from your dog's life, you can take that stress and add on to the length of their life. We show people how to do it, and we do it every day with more than 50 dogs in our house. And because we do this, right now, 30 of our 50 dogs have already lived more than twice their normal lifespan. I mean, that is incredible. And it can be done with every dog if you just know what to do.
What is the website address again where all of this great information is found?
It's gentlegiantsdogfood.com, and we have a section there called Special Feeding and Care Program. You know, I got to tell you, my wife and I have spent 25 years of our life learning this, and in less than 25 minutes, your listeners can learn what took us 25 years to learn.
Very good. Just a word or two about this show that made you so very, very famous way back in the 1960s, Batman. Are you surprised that that show still has such a powerful hold on so many people after all of these years?
Not really, and I'll tell you why. Batman was a different show. It was the first time in television history that instead of just a show that you watched, it actually interacted with our viewers. In other words, Adam and I used to say we put on our tights to put on the world. And we played with our audience. It's almost as though we reached through that television set and played with the kids and taunted the adults and just made it a fun experience for everybody. And because Batman was universal, you know, hero worship for kids, nostalgia for adults and for the college kids, the campy double-meaning style. There was something for everybody, and it has, in reruns, run for more than 50 years. Plus, I have two new movies out from Warner Brothers, animated with my voice. The first one's called Batman, Return of the Caped Crusaders. Adam West did the voice for that. I did the voice of Robin. And in the second newest one called Batman versus Two-Face, Adam West did the voice of Batman, I did the voice of Robin, and Two-Face is portrayed by none other than William Shatner. So here you have the two most iconic television shows in history, Batman and Star Trek, with the actors working together.
Not bad. And still kicking after all these years. As you went into that show, did you have any hesitancy about it, or did it seem like a good idea right from the start?
Well, I was a little intimidated by that costume, I have to be honest with you, okay? just a funny little anecdote. When I was doing the screen test, I had to put this costume on. Oh, my gosh, the most uncomfortable thing I'd ever put on in my entire life. And I had to have these wardrobe men help me put on this costume with the vest and the cape and the mask and the boots and all this stuff. And I remember distinctly, as I headed out towards the set to film my screen test, that I turned around and I mentioned to these two wardrobe guys, I said, well, the good news here is after the next 15 minutes with this screen test, I'll never have to put this costume on again. Famous last word.
Didn't quite work out that way, did it? You were You were actually quite an athlete, and I suspect that that actually came in handy when it came to doing a show like Batman.
Oh, absolutely. I was a martial artist. In fact, a piece of trivia for you is that I lived in the same complex of condominiums that Bruce Lee lives. And Bruce and I used to spar together. And a real piece of trivia is Bruce Lee's first film fight scene of his career was fighting me on Batman. And it was terrific. He was incredible. We were personal friends. I used to go down to Chinatown with his wife, Linda, and Brandon, who was 6 months old at the time. What a great guy. And, you know, as it turned out, when a piece of history, he became the most famous martial artist in cinema, you know, ever. And in fact, for me, 3 years ago, I was inducted into the International Karate and Kickboxing Hall of Fame. And you know, so if as being someone who was athletic really helped doing Batman.
Well, we are glad that you are devoting so much of your time now to this great cause, namely the care and rescue of beautiful dogs. And again, more information can be found at your website, which is www.gentlegiantrescue.com. Bert Ward, thank you so much for joining.
Also, our website, gentlegiantsdogfood.com, has got the latest information as well.
Very good. Bert Ward, thank you for joining me for the morning show. It was great to talk to you. Best wishes.
Thank you, citizen. To the Batmobile.
Bye-bye. It's 8:25, and you're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're dipping back into the archives more than a decade to the interview that I conducted with the author of a really remarkable book that, frankly, I had kind of forgotten about until a few months ago when my father and his wife were able to take a memorable trip to Alaska. And for that trip, they each brought along books about Alaska. And the book that my father chose was this book that you're about to hear about, called The Cruelest Miles. And he loved that book so much. And as he mentioned that, then it reminded me that I had had the pleasure of speaking to the author. So here is an extended excerpt from our conversation on The Morning Show here on WGTD. We are off to Alaska today on The Morning Show, and to the world of sled dogs, and to an incredible story that surrounds a diphtheria outbreak in the far-flung city of Nome, and the story of courageous men battling to race serum to the citizens of Nome in the midst of this terrible outbreak. It is an incredible story told in a marvelous book called The Cruelest Miles, the heroic story of dogs and men in a race against an epidemic. The authors are Gay Salisbury and Lainey Salisbury, who are cousins. And Lainey Salisbury joins us to talk about her book, which is published by W.W. Norton and Company. Lainey Salisbury, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Oh, thank you very much.
As luck would have it, the dust jacket of the book is back home. And so I think if I had that in front of me, I would know a little bit more about you and how you came to be interested in this particular story. Fill us in on that first, if you would.
Well, my cousin and I, as children, we grew up in the New York area, and we often met our families in Central Park. And as kids, we always climbed atop the Balto statue, which is one of the most well-visited statues in Central Park. And at the time, we had no idea what was behind the story. We had no idea of the story that was behind that statue.
A statue of a dog, we
yes.
should add.
Mm-hmm. But the true inspiration for the book came from an obituary that we read in the New York Times in January 1999. And it was the obituary of the last surviving driver of a team of sled dogs that went across Alaska to bring life-saving medicine to Nome. It was an incredible story. It brought up many elements about Alaska's history and the context of the time, and it completely captured our imagination. And my cousin and I have often done, you know, little adventures together. We've been biking and skiing and hiking in the woods, and we were so captivated that we decided to write a book.
How did you set about researching this chapter of history?
There was an incredible wealth of material. Even though all the drivers were dead, they had left behind very detailed accounts. Over the years, the local press in Alaska had interviewed the drivers of this race across Alaska, and you know, had a very good accounting of what happened to them on the trail. And we also found a box of telegrams that detailed for us, in a day-by-day, if not hourly, manner, what was going on in Nome at the time and what was going on in the trail and what was going on with the rescue effort in the lower 48, which came together to try and help Nome.
This was big news as this occurred, wasn't it? I mean, this was making headlines across the United States.
Yeah, in its time, it was as big of a story as Lindbergh crossing the Atlantic.
Hmm.
Every newspaper in the country ran banner headlines Every newspaper in the country ran banner headlines that told about the drama unfolding in the North. Those were the times when there were three or four papers a day. So for the first time, people in the lower 48 and elsewhere could read as this story unfolded. It was not unlike some of the coverage we see today of the war and of other pressing news.
Mm-hmm. As you wrote this book, as you researched this book, did you find your way to Alaska and even specifically to Nome, Alaska?
Oh, yes. We spent 3 months in Alaska, 3 or 4 months in Alaska. We went through pretty much every archive in every library from Juneau, which is on the southeast coast, to Fairbanks, which is the capital of the interior of Alaska. And we eventually made our way over to Nome, where we found the medical report that the lone doctor in Nome had left behind, as well as some other telegrams that we hadn't found previously. We also went back for another trip and went dog sledding just so we could, tell this story right.
Mm, very good. We're speaking with Lainey Salisbury, and her book is entitled The Cruelest Miles, The Heroic Story of Dogs and Men in a Race Against an Epidemic. She co-wrote the book with her cousin, Gay Salisbury. I wanted to make sure that we had time to talk a bit about Alaska itself, because I think that's one very commendable thing that you and your cousin do, is that you paint for us a very vivid picture of Alaska at this point in its history, when it's not yet a state, when it's simply a territory, and a really vast frontier, very mysterious sort of place. And I had not realized just how large a territory we were talking about, over 600,000 square miles, an area as big as England, France, Italy, and Spain combined.
Yes, it was immense. Not only was it immense, it was twice the size of Texas as well, as another comparison, but it also had three or four different weather climates. On the southeast coast, you had sort of a more humid, sort of Seattle-type weather. In the interior, you had a very deep, still cold. And on the northwest coast, the weather was mostly blizzard, clouds, gale-force winds. It was an extremely fascinating place to live, and it also required a certain type of person. There were only 55,000 people in the territory at that time, so people were really, they were strung far apart.
Hmm. And of course, Nome is perched right out on the westernmost point of Alaska, and I had not realized just 55 miles away was Russia.
Right, that was Nome's closest neighbor. It was closer to Siberia than to any other American or Alaskan town.
Incredible. You tell us in the first chapter of the book about how Nome sprang up in such inhospitable surroundings. It really sprang from the gold rush of 1896 and the famous Klondike River.
Yes, I mean, the natives who lived in Alaska at the time, the area of Nome was so exposed that they would never have built a town there. It took very desperate gold miners who were coming across from the Klondike, where gold had been discovered there a few years before, and when they heard that gold had been found in Nome in around 1899, a huge rush went across Alaska to get there, to see for people, desperate to get the first gold nuggets out.
One thing that you tell us in the book, which I had not realized, was that the United States had suffered a very serious economic downturn in 1893. And so this gold rush to Alaska comes in the wake of that, of the economic fallout. And so no wonder there was sort of a fevered pitch in the air with so many desperate people in search of a better life somehow. For many of them, they felt that this was the answer to their prayers.
Yes, for many, Nome was, their private El Dorado. They were so desperate that they believed stories that they read in the press that Nome's ocean was magical and that it brought gold in with every tide. It was also called a poor man's paradise. Because they believed gold was coming in through the sea, they didn't need special, the beach was public property, so they could just come in, stake a claim, and start digging.
You tell the story of a certain prospector named John Hummel, who sets in motion this story that gold could be found on the beach just outside of what became Nome, but how, because that news only reached the continental United States after the Bering Sea had frozen across, it was many months before anybody could make their way to Nome, and that almost ratcheted up the intensity of the gold fever then.
Yes, definitely. It gave the story time to travel around the world. So everyone rushed to Seattle, and they just clogged the town of Seattle and San Francisco, where they all waited to board the first boats to go out to Nome. So as the ice was breaking up, as it does every spring after a 7 or 8 month long winter, there were thousands of people in any kind of seaworthy vessel just waiting at the edge of the ice pack to descend upon Nome. And at its height, there were about 30,000 people in this town, and white tents, which were the symbol of the gold miners, stretched along the beach for, at least 8 miles in each direction.
You talk about in that summer of 1900, more than 20,000 chichicos arrived. Now, what does that term mean?
It's a term for newcomers to Alaska. People who didn't quite understand the climate that they were getting themselves into. Many of these people were unprepared for the winter that was about to descend upon them, which created a crisis in of its own. The federal government had to be called in to bring in troops to bring food and to help quell any sort of looting or chaos that may occur.
Tell us about the town that sprang up so quickly and so almost haphazardly.
They were so desperate to get stuff up so fast that they didn't realize that they were building too close to the sea. The Bering Sea is known for its tidal surges, and they paid no attention to the flotsam and jetsam that was on the shore, and they built up too close to the water. There were piles of lumber, piles of coal, canned goods stacked up along the beach, and they managed to build this town in about 3-4 weeks. And they're all false-fronted buildings because they didn't have enough time to, fully build them. And they're all, all made out of wood. There are some restaurants that were just, a tent on the beach.
I was amazed to read that by the end of that first summer, there were 16 law offices open for business along Front Street, 12 general stores, 4 real estate offices, and go on to talk about the laundries and the bathhouses and the cigar stores, watchmakers, and so on. A little later on, we read about 60-odd bars, and that tells us a lot about what this gunslinging town was all about.
Right. There's, when the sun stays up so long, people run out of things to do, so drinking certainly played a heavy part in it. There was also a red light district, and the women would come out to all these bars, and men would give them a dollar for a twirl. And a lot of the people who came up were lonely people, and they sometimes found solace in the beer bottle.
It was interesting to read that among the people that found their way to this new town was a gunslinger by the name of Wyatt Earp, made
right.
famous at the Old K Corral.
Yeah, he came up there towards the end of his career, and the bar that he built was one of the most popular at the time.
And then you tell us the story of September 12th, 1900, which was a terrible day for those that had settled into this brand new town.
Yeah, that was a defining moment for Nome. There was a huge storm that barreled up the Bering Sea, and of course Nome sits exposed right on the shore there, and it just clobbered Nome for several days, and the height itself was just a 24-hour period, and waves crashed over onto Front Street and sucked everything out to sea. Many of the miners were still in their white tents along the beach, and several were dragged out, and it was assumed that many had drowned. Boats were sunk, and the barges were broken up. And after that storm, many people decided that they had had enough, and they all emptied Nome, leaving behind just sort of a rugged 5,000.
I liked how you said that those who chose to leave Nome came to be called cold feets.
Right. Right, they got cold feet that they wanted to get out of there.
Right. Well, as you say, there are those hardy souls that are left in Nome, Alaska. And you go on to tell us about in that and in other locales, I suppose, in Alaska, that one thing that made life possible there was that which was provided by dog sleds, particularly for getting the mail. to a place like Nome, Alaska. Tell us how the mail was delivered and the role that dogs played in that.
Well, dogs were the backbone of Alaska's development. They were the ambulances, the long freight haulers, and the for many remote communities like Nome, they were the absolute lifeline. And since Nome was so isolated, as well as all the other small mining camps that had sprung up throughout the territory, miners really depended on that letter that came from home. So the mail drivers were considered the kings of the trails. Along the trail, which from the railhead at Nenana to Nome, was a 30-day dog trip. And there are roadhouses that were set up along the trail a day's travel apart where people could rest, you know, in their journeys. And at these roadhouses, the mail drivers were always giving the best seat of the house, which was always the warmest near the stove. People would save scraps of food for their dogs. They would often give the mail drivers presents. If there was a blizzard, they would go out and break out the snow for them so they would have a smooth trail. And they truly had the most dangerous jobs because they were on a schedule, and they would go out in pretty much almost any kind of weather.
You say that the most skillful drivers and trainers of dog teams were really quite well known throughout the Alaskan territory, almost like celebrities, particularly in the days of the All-Alaska Sweepstakes, which was a famous dog race which would occur. These were important people in Alaskan society.
Yes, and the most important one at the time was Leonard Sepala. He's one of the characters and heroes of our story. Throughout his lifetime, he had traveled 250,000 miles over Alaskan trails. And with his lead dog, Togo, who was just as famous as Leonard Sepala was in the territory, they had traveled 55,000 miles of trails together.
Incredible. You give us some very interesting technical information about how dog sled teams were put together. And one of the things you mentioned is that a dog team had to really be put together carefully so that they would meld as a group and that their respective strengths could work in concert. It wasn't enough to just string six healthy dogs together and hope for the best.
Right. You're basically dealing with different minds. If you had a 20-dog team, you had 20 different minds, and you had to train them and choose them carefully that all their temperaments matched or at least could be molded to fit the team.
Well, and you talk about how on a team there would be different dogs playing different roles.
Yes, the most important role is still today, is the lead dog. He is usually the smartest, the fastest, and the most courageous of the dogs on the team. They set the tone for the team. If the lead dog got scared, it would go throughout the entire team, and everyone else would get scared. They had to have sort of a zen-like quality of mind. When they hit danger, they had to be confident that they could get through it, because every other dog took its cue from the lead dog, sometimes even the driver.
You say at this point in time, in a place like Nome, there were more dogs than people.
Yeah, definitely. Each person needed a dog team if they wanted to get anywhere in Alaska, and, you know, dog teams could range in size from, you know, four dogs to 20.
I really like how you give us a detailed description of what Nome, Alaska became by the teens, when, of course, many of the initial gold miners have left, but some have remained, and they really carve out for themselves an amazingly fine life, complete with what you call a sort of windswept cosmopolitanism.
Right.
I mean, go ahead.
Yes, there are many different nationalities in Nome. There were Norwegians, there were Russians, there were people from Idaho and California and the East Coast. And they really tried to make that town work. I think they understood their isolation and how important it was to come together. So they set up libraries, you know, to keep them busy throughout the winter. They had, according to the newspapers, it sounded like they had a party every night. They had card games. They had dances. There was an opera and even a movie house.
Well, and you go on to describe how many of the citizens of Nome were actually very good citizens who lived there in a spirit of cooperation with one another. I mean, it was, I suppose, essential if one was going to live in a place like that, that one not live there looking out only for yourself, but you really needed to be looking out for your neighbor.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one never knew when they might get into trouble in Alaska. The weather could shift suddenly and dramatically. So you always had to count on your neighbor, who sometimes could be 200 miles away. you know, to help you out in a rough time. I mean, that's the person who will go out in the storm and come save you. And people expected that, you know, if they did a good turn, it would come back to them as well.
We're speaking with Lainey Salisbury, and she is one of the writers of a really marvelous book called The Cruelest Miles, the heroic story of dogs and men in a race against an epidemic. Before we talk about the epidemic, it's important, I think, for us to understand the seasons in a place like Nome, Alaska, and this long stretch of time during every year when Nome, Alaska would, for all intents and purposes, be cut off from the rest of the world. Explain that.
They said that there are two seasons in Nome. One is the 4th of July, that's summer, and the rest is mostly winter. the winter started around November. That's when the ice on the Bering Sea had frozen up and closed everything in, and that would last from November until about June, when it started breaking up again, and the boats were able to come in.
You tell the story of a boat called the Victoria, which was usually the first passenger ship to arrive in the spring and usually the last one to leave in the fall. And there would be sort of a poignancy, particularly as it would depart in the fall before winter. Those who would be left behind would really have a sense of utter isolation from the rest of the world in some ways.
Right. Yeah, one resident left behind said it was the worst day in his life. He said he felt like he was, you know, being stranded on an ice floe. And it's true, because when you're in Nome, I mean, there are no hills, it's just flat. So when you look around, all you see is white. There's just the white ice pack of the Bering Sea, which can stretch for 300 miles, you know, around. And when you look, you know, behind you at the tundra, that too is just a rolling mass of white fields.
I'd like to read just a portion of the opening of the book, if I may.
Sure.
As you describe this, I just wanted to read, as the weeks passed, the sun would sink lower beneath the horizon, and the fields of ice and snow would be transformed from the purest white to a wash of gold, and then to a violet twilight. The days were shorter now, just 4 hours of sunlight, and the temperatures plunged. Finally, a cavernous silence would descend on the coast like a great listening. At night, as the cold hung over the land, all of Nome's wildlife and every dog and his master would hunker down. The slightest movement could puncture the Arctic stillness, for the extreme cold amplified each sound. Far out at sea, one could make out the thunderclap of floes crashing into each other, and a hunter on land could hear the crunch of reindeer hooves on the crisp snow a few miles away, or the sound of a dog chewing on a bone. Then the blizzards descended, choking gusts of snow that one resident said draws the breath out of you, then fills your nostrils and drives it back again down your throat. Another simply stated that a blizzard in Nome could feel as if an unseen hand were clutching at my throat. One had to fight against the shrieking winds of Nome's winter storm, square one's shoulders, and lean forward with all one's weight to keep going. A short walk home through town could turn into an hour's haul, and one could easily lose one's way and end up dead on the tundra behind the town. It was as if the great ice age had returned. I love the way you write that, and that final line is masterful. I'm sure that is exactly how this must have felt to those who, even those who had to, in a sense, grow accustomed to this kind of a setting and environment. It still had to be extraordinary to be living in the midst of that.
Yes, I certainly think so. And, you know, I think they, although Alaskans tend to downplay the conditions under which they live, they do acknowledge it and respect it. And Nome at that time actually built on the cross that they had atop their church, they decided to put on lights and electrify it, just in case they do have a blizzard and someone, you know, wanders out in the tundra, they might have a chance of finding their way back by looking up for that constellation in the sky.
Almost immediately in the book, we meet Nome, Alaska's one and only doctor, Dr. Curtis Welch. And you mention somewhat ominously that as he was looking at his supplies, he had noticed that his antitoxin for diphtheria was much lower than he wanted it to be, and had ordered a new supply, but it had not come in. And the Victoria is leaving Nome, Alaska, and he realizes that they're going to have to try to make it through the winter with all that he has on hand. He is guardedly optimistic that it's not likely for any sort of diphtheria outbreak to occur, and of course, exactly that happens. Tell us about the opening days of this epidemic and a bit about diphtheria itself.
Well, at first, Welch, the Dr. Welch, the doctor in town, thought that he had been treating an unusually large number of sore throats and tonsillitis. Unfortunately, the early stages of diphtheria resemble severe sore throats and tonsillitis. And since Welch, according to his memoirs, had said he had never come across a case of diphtheria in all his 18 years of living in Alaska, he dismissed it as just just that severe sore throat. But then these children started dying, and he realized that children just don't die of a common cold in a sense. So he began to get suspicious, and the definitive case for him was a young boy named Billy Barnett who had the telltale sign of diphtheria, which is it's called a pseudomembrane. Diphtheria is an airborne bacteria that creates a toxin. It's that toxin that causes this membrane to form. It's sort of a combination of dead cells and blood clots. And these tend to form in the mouth and in the larynx. And if left untreated, that membrane just grows thicker and thicker and thicker. And these children suffer a horrible death. It's was likened to just a slow strangulation.
Mm. One of the things you mentioned is that a telltale sign or one of the most significant symptoms would be horrendous breath, I'm sure created by this awful thing growing in one's throat. But if you would open the mouth of a young person suffering from diphtheria, there would be this almost unearthly, horrific odor that would be one sign that that is what this likely was.
Right, yeah. It sounds horrible to say, but it's kind of like rotting flesh.
As soon as it became apparent to Dr. Welch that he had on his hand a very serious epidemic, what did he do? What was his next step?
Well, his first step was to quickly lock the town down under a quarantine. They had a emergency meeting of the town council, and they decided to close all the schools, to suspend. They knew that there were some card games going on, so they sent someone out of the meeting to quickly disband it, and they closed down the churches. And they heavily discouraged travel on the trails, particularly with children. Hmm. And then he, ran over to the office of the Telegram and sent a message that was soon heard around the world, in which he told officials in Washington that he had a diphtheria epidemic on his hands and he was in desperate need of 1 million units of serum to treat it.
You actually give us a copy in the book of the exact telegram that comes from Nome. An epidemic of diphtheria is almost inevitable here. Stop. I am in urgent need of 1 million units of diphtheria antitoxin. Stop. Exactly there. And he goes on to say, mail is the only form of transportation. We read those desperate words from Dr. Welch and can imagine the fear that must have swept over that town, particularly because many of its residents remembered not all that long before a terrible flu epidemic which swept through the area, correct?
Yes, that was part of the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918-1919. And in Alaska, Nome was one of the hardest hit towns. There were 91 orphans who were Eskimo who were, left victims of that disease. I can't remember the exact numbers now, but a large portion of the native population died, as well as a portion of the various whites who lived there.
You said the sickness left terrible emotional scars on Nome's survivors. This must have been an especially terrible day when they realized that yet another epidemic was about to sweep through their isolated community.
Oh, yes. They thought it was going to be a repeat of the Spanish flu. Because they all were, diphtheria was less of a common disease in the 1920s, but it was still in the memory of everyone because it was, at the time, still one of the greatest killers of children the world has ever known. So they also knew that it was, virulently contagious.
I think one of the great stories here is of Dr. Curtis Welch. He and his nurses really, on their own, contending as best they could with the event sweeping over the citizens of Nome, Alaska. You mentioned at one point that the nearest doctor was 400 miles away, a 10-day journey by dog sled. So Dr. Welch was, to a large extent, completely on his own.
Yeah, he certainly had his work cut out for him. I think we detected in some of his telegrams, too, that there was a sense of panic in his voice. When the story became well-known in the press. He even sent a very curt message saying, look, I'm not a press officer. Tell these reporters to back off. I'm too busy to deal with, you know, answering their questions. He only truly had his four nurses as his only advisors. And this was a man who actually had never even come across diphtheria. So I'm sure there was some, you know, confusion on his part, as well as a little bit of a feeling of helplessness.
Hmm. You are telling us in this book as well the decision that faced officials on how best to get the serum to the citizens of Nome that needed it so desperately, and there were really not very many options available to them. What were the two main possibilities?
Well, one possibility was at the time aviation was considered. In the lower 48, airplanes were taking over the country. They were delivering the mail and at times even delivering passengers. And Alaska desperately wanted to be part of that technological advancement. So there was a circle of people in Alaska at the time who wanted to push for an airplane rescue. But the planes in Alaska were, you know, they were old school. They were open cockpits. The engines were water-cooled, and antifreeze had not yet been developed. So, you know, it was expected that each plane would have two or three crashes in each season, and the season was only about 2 or 3 months long.
Mm. Well, and I think one thing that is particularly frightening about all of this is the fact that if the decision had been made to transport the serum by plane, and if that plane went down, down with it would go this precious serum.
Yeah, it was a great risk. And I think the governor, despite the pressure from many to go with the airplanes, realized that the only way to do it would be to rely on what really was an age-old technology, which was dog sledding.
Hmm. Tell us why even that option was a risky one. Tell us about the length of this journey and the danger involved in it. Why was even a trip overland by dog sled not a sure thing at all?
Well, particularly that winter as well, there was a cold snap in the interior, which had driven temperatures to about 65 degrees below zero, which is, unbelievably frigid temperatures. And the trail in of itself was not a straight line. It was, you know, it was curvy. It was over frozen rivers, which often, you know, which could easily crack up. There are obstacles at every turn around the trail, not to mention just one's own ability to stay warm behind a dog team. We came across many stories of, you know, other people who had gone down the trail had fallen through the ice or had, you know, suffered severe hypothermia to the point where, you know, they eventually just lost their way and died. And, you know, if you survived the still cold of the interior, there was still the coast that these drivers had to contend with, the coast of the Bering Sea, where blizzards were frequent and gale-force winds were pretty much the norm.
Gay Salisbury. She is the co-author of this remarkable book about this heroic struggle to reach far-off Nome, Alaska with much-needed serum. And to hear the end of this story, you need to take up this incredible book, again titled The Cruelest Miles, the heroic story of dogs and men in a race against an epidemic. This book was published way back in 2005. A pleasure to dust off this interview from the Morning Show archives and share it with you today on WGTD. Tomorrow on the Morning Show, I am excited to share with you an interview that I will be recording a little bit later this morning with two people involved in the crafting of a brand new work, My Real Mother. And we're going to be talking with director Maggie Spanuelo from the music theater faculty at Carthage and Riley Thomas, a New York-based playwright and composer who has crafted this work. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find The Morning Show archived on our website, wgtd.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. We're approaching 9 o'clock.